Welcome to the Due Diligence Podcast, where we explore how leaders make and execute their biggest decisions, from transactions to founding organizations to career pivots and beyond. This podcast is produced by Sipping Giant Capital. We connect executive talent and capital to invest in West Michigan businesses. To learn more, visit us at slippinggiantcapital.com or stop by our office in downtown Kalamazoo.
Tom, welcome to the podcast, sir. It is fantastic to have you. I was super excited to have you as a host or to have you on the show. I think you've got a great message for our listeners. So thank you for joining us today. Where are you sitting, by the way? It looks beautiful.
I'm sitting in my, I have a country home just north of Toronto. So I'm in the country. I'm in the middle of a forest. It's actually the place where I wrote the three books in the trilogy. It's a very quiet, peaceful place. And this is my kind of go-to place for thinking and writing.
I forgot until you said that I'm also Canadian. I grew up in Thunder Bay, Ontario. So I also forgot. I was just in Toronto last weekend. I took my son to the Hockey Hall of Fame. We were just there. You forget how beautiful it is downtown.
I married a girl from Thunder Bay, so we got a lot in common. We could take this in a whole bunch of different directions.
Oh, really? That's super interesting too. We'll talk about that at a different time. And my sister lives down there. I love Toronto. It's a fantastic spot. My son was amazed just as we drove by because we live in a small town now. But yeah, let's talk about, you wrote these three amazing books, Tom, and it really is about helping family businesses, helping transfer businesses, succession. You are the thought leader in this space. So if anybody is wondering who you are the ultimate thought leader in business succession, but especially family business succession. I mean, your first book was really about family dynamics and how to have honest conversations. So, for those unfamiliar, talk about, your stance, where you come from, and give kind of brief introduction on, your latest book, The Happy Inheritor, came out more recently. But, give a brief introduction of your stance and why you went down this pursuit to live in a forest somewhere near Toronto and write three books on to help families, sell and transfer their legacies.
Yes. Yeah. So I'll make this super quick. I don't want to turn this into the Tom Dean show, but super, super quick. I started my career in banking, having just finished my PhD over in England, came back, started to work in the banking sector, and then joined a family business. We had a large plastics manufacturing business. I ran that for 8 years as CEO. I was actually buying shares in that family business before I even joined as an employee. I'm going to get into that later. But I wrote about things that I've lived and experienced. This isn't kind of fantasy land. I've actually lived it, scaled the business, sold the business, and then wrote about that. And that has turned into a 17-year career as a full-time professional speaker. And this is a good place to remind listeners that if they hear something, and I think they will today, that they find interesting and they want more, yeah, definitely do not call me. That is not. I don't consult. I don't. I actually don't sell anything other than my book. I am a speaker. I do over 100 conventions a year all around the world. I've delivered over 2,000 paid speeches in 28 countries. So that is my gig. So I like to make that clear up front because I'm not pitching. There's no back-end kind of business offering that I'm trying to pitch in my remarks. I'm a thought leader. So there are going to be some things that I say today that people are going to disagree with. Good. That means I'm doing my job. I'm not a big fan of love-ins and, just keep on repeating conventional wisdom. That's not what I do. I actually push the boundaries of conventional wisdom around the subject of transitioning family businesses, family wealth. It is a very, very interesting subject that has been largely avoided. We have a situation right now where 137 million American and Canadians are missing the most important document in an estate plan. And that's a will. Now, if you're a business owner and you don't have a will, newsflash, you don't have a succession plan. The state of Michigan's got one for you.
Yeah. Yes, this is true.
Half of all business owners in Michigan don't have a will. So by logical extension, follow me here, half of all business owners in Michigan have no succession plan.
What?
Zero.
So true. So that's the legal part of this, right? If someone hits me, that's the tragedy part. If something happens to me, who takes over my business, right? I think your books get way out in front of most of that, right? When you're speaking through things. Talk about so besides forgetting the whale wrong, right? Everybody gets a whale. That's, we can check that box. Let's talk about some of your advice or some of your thought leadership, because really, I still remember your first book. I think it was your first book, The Every Family's Business. The two guys on the plane, one sold his business happily, one not so well with the family, miserable, and they're on their way to the Barbados, both of them. So talk about what are some things that you highly suggest that business owners should do if, especially when they have family in the business. You have 12 important questions in your book. We can go through each one of those, but like high level, what are the most important things that families should mindset, start there, approach and mindset.
Yeah, so, and this is, I'll start off with the controversial piece. I mean, what I'm asking business owners to do is to build a business that is sellable, a business that will be sold, either internally inside the family or outside. But this idea of gifting an operating business for free to the next generation for no financial consideration is one of the most dangerous, toxic, and wealth-destroying ideas on the planet.
What?
That's all I wrote. That
Yeah.
was the, I, it's the first book. Every single book on family businesses has talked about how to do the opposite, how to have family meetings and gather and talk and prepare the next generation to take over the family business. And old is good and built to last. It's nonsense. The reality is, businesses do not last.
Okay.
It's not a personal perspective, it's the data. Of the 100 largest firms in America in the year 1900, only 16 were still in business in the year 2000, 100 years later. That is an alarming amount of wealth destruction in the modern economy. And yet it's always been there. And yet, what do family businesses do? They subscribe to this idea that it's the job of the founder to build a business that endures beyond their own life. And if they do that, that's the hallmark kind of moment of success. Old is good, fourth generation family business, clearly more successful than the third generation more successful than the second. It's they're chasing the wrong metric. Business owners shouldn't be chasing the longevity of a single stock, a single business. They should be pursuing the longevity of their wealth. Those are two very different conversations.
Yeah, so if you went to the purpose-driven person, right? My purpose, my legacy is my business. I shouldn't be looking at money and wealth as my outcome. How do you speak to that person? Because there is a lot of people that say you have to train Junior, send Junior, and I'm using Junior, a daughter or son, send Junior away for 5 years to get experience before they come back, and then they'll be ready for the leadership of the business and take over. And the data on the third generation is, usually that one's never more successful than the second. But yeah, so talk to that person that says, well, what you're just money hungry or wealth driven.
Yeah, so really, what you just did is what most business owners do. I know you're kind of channeling their, their thought process. Send Junior away for 5 years. He'll come back, he'll be ready to take on a leadership role. I'm not writing about that. I'm not talking about management succession planning. I am talking about ownership succession planning. You could have a son or daughter that goes to Harvard. Has a Harvard MBA, is phenomenal, phenomenal manager, a phenomenal leader. But guess what? They're not owners. Guess what owners do different than managers? They risk capital. What do the vast majority of family business owners do? They gift their business to their children and allow that rising generation to skip the most important step, which is go to a bank, borrow money, get skin in the game, don't sleep particularly well for 3 or 4 years like the founder didn't, right? So that step is skipped, and it's disastrous. We actually thrust the next generation into positions of ownership without any conversation or preparation. And of course, the data is clear. Only 30% survive. 30% of family businesses that are gifted survive to the second generation. And of that 30%, only 10% make it to the third generation. So if you have a founder who is listening in today and their plan is to gift their business to their children, they have a 3% chance of their grandchildren owning and operating their business. Three.
3% chance. Well, how about that data point? So if and your suggestion or your controversy of all of this is, which is very controversial to many, do not gift to your kids. Make them buy it, right? And for fair value, not even like give them a discount, even over fair value, or compare it to market rates. That's the kind of the theme in your business. Go
Oh,
get a
100%.
market offering and compare to that market offering. And the basis of that is, so you sleep with one eye open at night because the capital's on the line, your house is on the line, everything's on the line, and that is a growth period for that new owner, not leader, owner. Talk
Yeah,
about that. Go ahead.
desperation is the mother of invention. And when people risk their capital and they need to drive innovation and change in a business, that is what has been the narrative behind some of the greatest success stories. What we have in family businesses, when businesses are gifted, we know that that there is an appalling lack of innovation. Why? Precisely the way that the transition was structured. Have you ever received a gift from a family member? Like a birthday present?
Yeah, for sure.
Did you take that gift the next day and take it to a pawn shop and sell What do we do with gifts? We keep them and we honor them exactly the way they were given. Now, let's apply that to a family business. Here's the family business. It's a 100-year-old farming operation or a manufacturing business. It's yours. That rising generation will take that business and run it like a steward, like a curator of a museum. They run it exactly the way they got it. That is why the success rate is so appalling. How do you change? They don't have authentic permission to change the business model, the product mix, the pricing. They literally are stuck in time, and it's a
That
disaster.
analogy is really good, Tom. I gotta give like you receive a gift from a parent or a wife. My wife gives me great gifts actually, so I don't want to get myself in trouble. But you receive a gift, you take it, and if you don't like it, you still keep it and you put it on a shelf and you honor it and it's there and you just you keep even when you shouldn't. Like it's taking up space, you're never gonna use it, but you keep it. And so, and your theory behind all this, and between the lines, is if you give to your child, they don't have the pressure to do the innovation, the desperation to innovate, change, or the authority or the belief. They're just trying to hold that gift and sustain it.
And sustain it to the next generation, to their children. So this, and you know, these there's a lot of trauma inside family business. There's a lot of people who are stuck in the business. In many cases, they're stuck for fear that if they leave, they'll be disinherited. That's a whole separate conversation. But there's a lot of people who literally repeat family trauma. And so the idea is they've been gifted a business, they run it long enough till their children are old enough. And then they do exactly the same thing their parents do. They reel in their children using inflated salaries and incentives to distort decision making. And they lure that next generation to the business, and then they're stuck. And that business owner has effectively painted themselves into a corner. Because how do you sell a business when your children are deriving a lifestyle or an income from that business? How do you sell a business without selling your family in the process? The reality is, you can see the conundrum. You can see what gets started. So I always say, listen, every family business is born from love. We don't invite our children into our business because we loathe them or hate them. We think we want them to enjoy the same opportunity that we enjoy, to enjoy the same experience of starting and growing a business. So the reality is, there can only ever be one founder in a business. The founder risked capital. The founder had a dream. The founder built something from nothing. And then the next generation, they can never be a founder. They're always participating in the perpetuation of someone else's dream. And it's soul destroying. They're stuck. How do you get out?
Soul destroying. It's interesting because even when you see Sims in our line of business, you see Sims from investment bankers, and you got three family members in there. They're overpaid, and their salaries get readjusted. That gets readjusted to the bottom line, and I'm like, well, where are they going post close? Is everybody leaving? It's so interesting. Soul destroying. It's not only hurts the business; it is soul destroying for Junior to never be the founder. So okay.
And you do get two types of personality. So you'll get that next generation who will overperform in order to demonstrate to their parent who has given them this opportunity that they're actually harder working, smarter, and going to produce better results. Or you get the other child who's been infantilized, never really allowed to grow up and perform. They're always kept in that kind of subservient servant role. And they're really, that is a disaster. That's a ticking time bomb. I mean, you can flip the script and everything that I'm saying, you could flip upside down. If you really want to buy a family business at a discount, look for multiple family members. Look for an old multi-generational family business. I guarantee you it's a three-ring circus. It's a disaster. And they're just looking for a way out. So if you come in with a serious offer, but it can be discounted, most people will take it because it's insane. There is a tremendous amount of suffering and litigation going on in family businesses. The courts in Michigan are absolutely jam full of families in disputes over the succession rights of these businesses, particularly if business owners don't have a will, which, as we have already covered, half of them don't.
Yeah, the will thing is funny. The craziest one I've seen was there is a ex-wife and new wife, and the lawyers of the new wife just said, "Hold on, because the ex-wife will pass away soon, and then you'll get it all." And I was like, "This is incredible." And the president who took over is trying coming to us trying to get help, and I'm like, "I can't help you with that one." I mean, this is interesting. Pulled with litigation. So suggestions. Let's go to suggestions. So do not gift your family business, right? Sell it, even if it is to Junior or to whoever you think in the family that should buy it. It could be an aunt, uncle, or because the other problem is you get one founder, then it gets a second generation and there's three kids, right? And then it gets to the next generation, then there's 12 grandkids, right? So you've got this problem of the number of shares, right, are no longer motivating enough, sometimes to 12, and who gets what. How do we, where does a business owner start? You're a founder. Where should I start? What should I do? What's the first thing I should do?
The very first thing you should do is get a third-party valuation done, an independent valuation with integrity. So first of all, you know what your business is worth, not putting your finger in the air and kind of saying, I think it's worth maybe between 1 and 3 million. No, go and get a proper valuation, a number with integrity. There are some business owners who time their succession plan based on a number. When my business becomes $5 million, I'll have enough to retire. Meanwhile, the business is worth eight. They've already overshot that number. Or it's well below 5 million. Like they're off by millions. They have no idea. So you need to deal with reality. What is your business worth? Where are you? So that's the starting point. Once you have a proper valuation, you can determine what your current share price is. And then, what I'm trying to do in the book with the 12 questions is just give a business owner a process to determine whether or not you have a buyer in the house. You can use these 12 questions to begin a conversation with a key employee to find out whether or not they want to risk their capital and buy your business. You can use the 12 questions to find out whether or not you have a son or daughter who wants to risk their capital and buy your business. If the answer comes back, no, you have neither, well, guess what, Derek? Your list of options is getting short. You're really left with private equity or a strategic buyer, someone in your value chain, supplier, customer, competitor, or you can go public. You can do employee buyout and ESOP, but no one is inventing new ways to exit. And here's what I do know for 100% certainty. When you die, you can't take it with you. The Egyptians tried. Businesses and gold, even being buried with their slaves, it did not travel well.
Yes, it did not. So get we had Adam Evaluation was actually the episode before you. So if anybody's curious, watch the previous episode. We had a valuation company in West Michigan, the most well-known one around us, and just like how to start, where to go. So get a proper valuation. And you said something really critical there. Find out who in the business is willing to risk their capital to buy the business. Right. Isn't that an important conversation and reality? So instead of finding out who's willing to risk and having fights over how much it's worth, and because a lot of times you've probably heard this a lot, and you're the sellers and the buyers are not, I mean, sometimes they're miles and miles apart. And so even the valuation person who has to deliver that message to the seller, they're miles apart. And sometimes you overshoot, you're worth more, and sometimes you're worth much less than you actually think you are. So that's the first step. And then having that critical conversation about who's willing to risk that amount of capital. What if you have nobody? So, and you also said that there's not new ways to exit being invented. There are some new creative ways. We're trying to create a little bit of a one, but talk about how you can have that ominous conversation with Junior when Junior doesn't have that kind of wealth, right? If Junior doesn't have enough wealth, what is Junior supposed to do, right? Junior can't buy me out. They don't have the capital. They've been my employee. I've paid them $100,000 a year. My business is worth 15 million. How are they going to buy me out?
Yeah, it's a great question. So when I'm doing a convention, auto dealer convention, plumbing convention, I do conventions all the time. For every sector, every vertical has a convention. I'm that guy who's giving that talk on the subject of succession planning. I get that question all the time. I often say that in the room, there are parents who think their children will buy the business and children who think their parents will gift the business. And no one knows how to start the conversation. The conversation feels so dangerous and potentially toxic. It's avoided. And of course, life unfolds. People get sick. People die. And then where do the shares typically go in the event of incapacitation or death, especially? Typically, they're going to surviving spouses. Derek, I get more phone calls from elderly women. Remember, women in America live 6 years longer on average than men. Okay? I get more phone calls from elderly women whose business owner husbands have predeceased them. And you know what they tell me? They want to bring their husband back from the dead and kill them themselves.
Yeah, I
They
can see
are
that.
not happy. They are not happy. They don't have operational knowledge. They don't have relationships with the lenders. They don't have relationships with the clients or the customers. Key employees bolt for the door when the business owner dies. What has taken decades to build, the value, gets destroyed and unravels in a matter of weeks and months. And remember, when business owners create wealth, where do they store their wealth? They store it in the equity of the business. They don't pull it out. They don't want to pay taxes. So they become their own lender. They buy their own buildings, fund their own receivables, fund their own inventory. They become their own lender. They concentrate their wealth in one illiquid stock called their family business with no succession plan, and then they die. So, to come back to your original question about how the next generation can afford to purchase that business, I am a huge proponent of facilitated family meetings. A lot of people who hire me are wealth advisors, insurance companies, to bring this message to their clients. And the message that I'm saying is have a family meeting with a trusted advisor, your attorney, your accountant, your wealth advisor, and start to plan the intergenerational transition of wealth. Like build a transparent plan. That, by the way, the Rockefellers did this 125 years ago. This is not rocket science. Just that very few people do this, but some do, and they do a really good job of it. They don't die and then have a gender reveal party, right, and say, surprise, here's how it's going to go down. No. Smart families get out in front of this and say, someone will die. And when they do, here's how things will transition. And everyone's a part of that plan. It's been discussed and prepared, and documents are shared and up to date. So, in family meetings, smart families are actually transitioning surplus capital while they're alive. And while they're doing that, they're asking the rising generation if they want to risk capital and buy shares in the family business. And oh, by the way, don't tell me you don't have money. Because we just gave you some.
There you go.
So what I'm describing is the next generation risking inherited wealth. They're actually risking their inheritance to purchase the business. Guess what, Derek? They don't want to do that unless they truly, truly believe in their own capacity to grow that business. So if the children don't want to return money that has been gifted and buy shares at full market value based on a third-party valuation, the business should be readied for sale.
So that's a key part of your book, right? The business should always be ready to be sold, right?
Correct.
Get it so it can be ready to be sold. Get outside offers, right? And those outside offers should be considered all the time at the family meeting. And correct me if I'm wrong, I'm doing this a little bit from memory, but you suggest a family meeting at least once a year, and that plan is updated every single year, and roles are given out every single year, and everybody is knows who was willing to buy and not willing to buy at that family meeting. Is that about right of the general high philosophy of those 12 questions? What am I missing too?
No, you've got that. It's the secrecy that is destroying families from the inside out. You see, because families, business owners store their wealth in the equity of their business, when there's only one of their children, one sibling in the business, say one or two outside the business, the children outside the business believe that the one inside the business has a kind of a jump on the money. They have a front row seat. Mom and dad love them the most. They're closest to the money, understand the money. And then, of course, if there's no family meeting, no communication, no family governance, no community, like just pure secrecy and silence around how that business is going to transition, that family will unravel. Because when someone dies, when the business owner dies, and I don't know if you know this, they all do, what do the children, and say, then the money goes to the surviving spouse, typically a woman. And then the surviving spouse dies trying to run a business they don't understand. Then where do the shares go? The shares go down to the children, typically in equal amounts, right? Thrusting brothers and sisters into business together as equal business partners. What's that look like on Monday? What do the children outside the business want from their brother or sister who's inside the business? I'll give you a hint. It rhymes with funny.
Yes. I was going to say distribution, but you were a little more direct with the money.
They want money and they want it quick, exactly. And if there's no third-party valuation, the children outside the business have inflated ideas of what the business is worth. And then, of course, if they don't get that money or as much as they think they're owed, they lawyer up, and here we go again. One more time.
I think so one of the hidden messages in your book, I think, is if you don't have the honest conversations, the business is almost secondary. You're going to ruin your family. Like you're actually going to, you just mentioned it, like you're going to create a huge divide and ruin your family forever if you do not have these conversations, which is probably more important than the money, which you can't take with you anyway, right? Is that a hidden message for you? Like, save your family. It's almost more important than saving the business.
Oh, well, listen, I'm really blunt on this subject. I actually argue in the book and in my public lectures that a business is not the legacy. It's not the legacy. They're told it's the legacy. They're told culturally that it's the thing that they'll be remembered for. I'm going to put you on the spot, Derek. I do this all the time in conventions. Don't feel bad.
Okay,
Who
I'm
was the
ready.
founder of Coca-Cola?
Oh, who is the founder of Coca-Cola? Oh, one of the people here right now actually was CHR of Coca-Cola. I should know that. I don't know.
Okay, so when I'm doing a convention, I got a 500 people, 1,000 people in my audience. I do that. I ask that question rhetorically. Same answer. Crickets. No one knows. No one even Googles it. No one cares. That's the third most valuable consumer brand in the world, and no one can remember who the founder is. Now let's think of Larry's, machine shop, CNC, or some auto parts guy in Michigan. Like, seriously, you think that 5 years, 10 years, 15, 20 years after your death, people are going to remember the great founder of Larry's Tool and Die Shop? No one cares. So it does beg the question, if your business is not your legacy, what is? And I think you're right. I think it is your family. I think a business owner who understands what a business is and what it's not a legacy, it's not a pet, it's not a friend, it's not your community. It is an instrument of wealth creation. It's a stock that goes up in value or down in value. What I'm describing is a really organic view of what business is, right? When you incorporate a business, lawyers will tell you're putting a legal entity, a person, notionally, that sits in between you and your customer and limits the liability that you have. So any business that is incorporated is born. And anything that is born will one day say it.
Die.
Yeah, it's super empowering when a business owner can actually say, one day my business will die. Now they're awake and they're really thinking about their business in a very different way, which is, where is my business in its life cycle? It's not a toddler. It may be in business for 15 years. It may not be a teenager, or it may be in critical care. It may be like, I don't know, if you're doing, I don't know, printing flyers for direct mail, well, you're probably in an old folks home. That business is kind of done. Are you going to really give that business to your children for free? That's going to be your legacy. Every single business has a beginning, middle, and end. It's something that we really don't look at, study, or talk about. And I think the smartest, well, I would argue that the most successful family business in the history of the planet, the Rothschilds, for over 350 years, have mastered the idea of knowing when to get into a business is as important as knowing when to get out. And they don't get emotional. They don't get emotional about their investments. Business is not family.
So that's a really interesting perspective, because we have a lot of conversations, right? We sometimes, we even as buyers, we say, hey, we'll protect your legacy. Don't sell to private equity. Sell to this new leader who's going to risk capital with us to buy your business, to innovate and grow it to the next life cycle, right? Can you continue life cycle? Can you continue it from dying? But having a business owner say, this is your stock. It's a stock. You own stock in a company. It's your wealth. That's all it is, right? Your family's more important. That's an interesting perspective in general, right? Because so many business owners see it as an extension. It's almost an appendage, right? Their business is that. It's their entire identity. Their entire identity is wrapped up, and they like going around saying, I'm the founder and owner of X.
Yep.
Right. It gives them power in the community. They're on boards and they're on. And what you're saying is disconnect all that. Wrong approach.
Well, yeah. And the reality is, when people, business owners, practice their philanthropy through their business, when their business merges with their own personal identity, they won't sell that business. Metaphorically, the sale of the business represents their death. So they hang on to it. They hang on to it. It is their persona. It is everything. And so that's toxic. That's dangerous. That is unbelievably dangerous for a business owner and a business owner's family. As soon as you say my business will never be sold, you're in big trouble.
Toxic and dangerous. Who founded Coca-Cola, by the way? Do you have the answer? Or do you even know?
I keep forgetting to Google it myself. I don't care. I'm just not interested.
Yeah, trick. Not interested, right?
Not interested. Listen, I get that what I'm saying is hard for founders to hear. And listen, I'm trying to be a little bit jarring, but I can tell you, watching a business owner stay too long, or to build a business that is truly overly dependent on them because they are the business, it is heartbreaking to watch the devastation to the family members around that person, or that rising generation who's been set up to fail, to set up to pursue one goal, which is the perpetuity of a business, which is insane. I'm quite literally trying to flip the script, because I know that those business owners are turning to their most trusted advisor. Who's that? It's attorneys and accountants.
Accountants. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Accountants typically first. Now, I'm not going to paint a nefarious plot by all accountants to destroy family businesses. But listen, if you're the accountant and the business is sold, what happens to the file?
It's gone.
Right.
The services
are gone. We have business
owners
turning to their two most trusted advisors, attorneys and accountants, saying, hey, I'm moving into my 70s. I got 80% of my wealth wrapped up in this business. I really need to get accelerating on my thinking and my planning on succession planning. What should I do? And guess what they hear?
Fine Junior carried on, keeping the family, your legacy, you've built this.
You've got great kids. This has been the best investment of your life. You've got 18% return on invested capital. Why would you sell this business? It's been the best thing you've ever done. And your kids, you got great kids.
Mm. Yeah. Now, they keep the file, they keep the book. You know who does tell them to sell is sometimes if the bankers have debt in that business. Your age is like one of their risk factors, I feel. I've heard a couple of bankers say, well, you know, this person is like, we've got debt with them. They're a little bit older. They've risked capital with us. We're starting to get worried about our debt.
Oh, listen, and this is why family businesses are incredibly private and keep all of the chaos that's swirling around and all the interpersonal challenges in the family and outside the family around business succession planning. They keep a lid on that, because they know that is actually a measurable risk, and bankers are getting tired of wearing it. So no, they're looking, actually they're pressing for much clearer, better examples, transparency around that, the planning. It's a big problem. And of course, you know, I always like to say, and this is going to sound really hard for the next gen to hear, but I was recently golfing with a friend who's got an executive search firm. And I asked them, what's your process for finding a new CEO of a business? So, you know, this is how it goes. 30 seconds. He says he starts with a database of 5,000 resumes. He'll put a search team of three young associates on that. They'll whittle that down to 100 candidates, whittle that down to 25, whittle that down to 10. They'll put one executive search, a senior person on that, start face-to-face interviews, whittle that down to three candidates, more interviews, face-to-face. Finally, they select one candidate after months of searching. What's the likelihood that the best candidate to run a family business will come from a pool of two children?
Oh, very, very small, right? You got a pool of 5,000 whittled down to one versus a pool of three and whittled down to one. But you must find, you must find a lot of owners, or at least maybe the ones, some of my mentors that own businesses, they don't think Junior can do it. A lot of them are like, there's no way my kids are good enough, right? They're not taking this over. I have to sell. So what do those owners do? What do you suggest to those? I mean, is it just an honest conversation with the kids? You're not going to get this unless you want to buy it?
Yeah, I think at some point there needs to be a really, really honest conversation where the business owner says, look, this business is too big for you to afford. But if I have a liquidity event, here's what I'd like to do in terms of my intergenerational transition to family wealth. I'd like to, take some of that sale proceeds and start to help you guys. Maybe explore your own business, maybe in a different sector or something you're talented at. Or, I think those honest conversations. But I'll tell you, it gets really, really convoluted when you've got the real CEO, the chief emotional officer, which is often spouses, mm-hmm. who are using the family business to provide employment for their children, to get access to the grandchildren. Like, there's a lot of stuff going on, a lot of stuff to unpack that really prevents businesses from ever going to market. I do a lot of speaking for investment firms, a lot of M&A conventions, and there's a massive amount of businesses that never go to market, never will go to market, because transactional firms think that money is the driver in a liquidity event. And that if they can, dangle a big enough number, a business owner will say, oh my God, absolutely. Let's go. Let's hit the go. It's go time. Listen, you have no idea how many business owners will never go to market because of the family dynamics that are preventing them. Conversations about one day all this will be yours. And how do you walk that promise back? But the reality is you can. In fact, the reality is that most rising gens want that business sold and would like that family to have a liquidity event and then help to transition living gifts. Living gifts are a big trend right now, particularly after a liquidity event. But this only happens through proper family governance, with really good advisors convening family meetings, really building structure, process, family constitutions, good. And I write about this in my third book, The Happy Inheritor, where I talk about families that do have liquidity events and how they manage that, how they navigate that, and how they don't wait for death to transition wealth. They actually start to transition wealth while they're still alive. It's a really big trend, and it's really helping families navigate a complex and emotional challenge.
So one more question, or something we see. You keep talking about chaos. You've said it probably three times, family dynamics, chaos. And then we'll get into the steps, what to do, who to hire, and some suggestions. And your example was spot on, right? Who's the real CEO, right? It's the spouse at home that is got employment for their children, access to grandchildren, like total chaos. And oftentimes the decision maker as buyer, sometimes we say, are they married? What's the spouse think? Where's the spouse? What are they doing? And sometimes you like in Michigan, we say, oh, the spouse is living in Florida. We're like, what? They're already down there. They're already retired. They've been down there for years. They don't even come up to Michigan anymore. I'm like, what's this owner doing? Is their spouse is in Florida and they're not even there?
What that owner is doing is going to the oldest page in the playbook, which is bring children in, train them up, move them into increasing responsible positions, and then semi-retire, and then draw a salary while your children run your business. Guess what, Derek? It's not working. It's not working for a couple of reasons. One, it used to work because you didn't have two kids. You had seven kids. So statistically, there was a higher probability that one actually had a head on their shoulders, could actually do the job, and actually may have worked harder and been smarter than the parent. Now you got two kids. They're better educated. They've got their own dreams and aspirations, but they're, you know, they've been incentivized. They've been lured into the business and kept there with inflated salaries. And then mom and dad are going to not die at age 72 when he has a heart attack. He's going to have a heart attack at 72. Now he's going to get a stent and run four more marathons. He's going to go to 92, except Junior's going to be in his 60s or 70s. And he, listen, they get fed up. They want what their parents wanted, which is not money. What's more intoxicating to an entrepreneur than money? What's more intoxicating?
Oh, I guess I had to think work and time, right?
Freedom, control, freedom.
Yeah.
Right? Design your, that's what founders were chasing. Sure, they wanted to make money, but really they're independent souls. They really can't work for people. I can't.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm an entrepreneur. I mean, I like creating things and working to my, I don't know, my own beat and my own drum. The rising generation ultimately gets fed up. They want control and it's denied. There isn't even conversation about how voting control will transition. And they often quit in their 50s and 60s, leaving their parents in their 70s and 80s high and dry. Now there really is no succession plan. Now you have a business owner in their 80s trying to sell a business and they're running out of gas. They have no idea. The business is tanking. Or even worse, that business owner in their 70s or 80s does this thing. It drives me wild. They take their foot off the gas and they go, I like my business. I've got 100 employees. I just like it the size that it is. And so they then start to turn off the tap. They starve it of capital. They don't want to spend more money on that business and put another addition on the plant, right? They want to keep it exactly the way it is. Well, listen, businesses go up in value or they go down in value. They don't go sideways. That's always an early sign of decay and succession planning crisis.
They're dynamic. Businesses are dynamic. They're out, they're moving, right? And they've got to be innovating. They've got to be growing. We see this all the time. We see businesses that were once good and then TTM. We're looking at trailing 12 months. So it's month over month that your business is declining in value. And we've seen a lot, even the first half of this year, we've seen a lot of softness. But that's the value of your stock is, you know, essentially you're trailing 12 months. Maybe there's a couple of years you look at, but you can see when it starts to go down and it's never stable. It's dynamic all the time. You said something interesting. Let's talk about what to do, because I think the core of this is the children have their own aspiration, their own goals. And now there's this way of living wealth transfer, right? Sell your prize entity while it's at its top, right? And that's what we want as buyers. Everyone thinks buyers want a deal. I want the ultimate business for a buyer is a business that is doing great. It's generating capital. We can put some debt on it. We can risk our own capital. We'll get a return on that capital. We can thrive it with more energy and grow it. That's what we want, right? We don't want something going the other way. Then we got a bunch of problems to deal with that you didn't deal with, right? So I think sellers and buyers are more aligned than most people think and what they want. So in an ideal situation. So ideally, you think the owner should sell and then give Junior the resources, not free, the resources to do what they want to do. But also, you're probably the most skilled person in the family as the founder in helping people navigate challenging situations. And now you give them more time to consult them and give them advice and help them along their journey, right? Is that what we're talking about here?
That is exactly what I'm talking about. Notionally, imagining that our children aren't some carbon copy or version of us. One of the greatest gifts we can give our children is the freedom and the access to family capital to go off and pursue the dreams that are authentic to them. That is an extraordinary gift and it's rare. But when it's done, this is how strong dynamic families really grow, protect, and transition family wealth. By really allowing children to fail, encourage failure, encourage risk-taking, but encourage people to swing for the fence and pursue their dreams. That's very different from infantilizing a child and saying, hey, we've been making plastic auto parts for 30, 40 years, and even the unborn will be making plastic auto parts because that's all we've ever been and that's all we'll ever be. Can you imagine how suffocating that is as a concept, as a family culture?
Yeah, I but this notion of sell your business and become the mentor, right? What
I
is
like
someone
that.
swinging for the fences that's out there on their entrepreneurship journey? What do they need more than anything? Yeah, capital. They need capital. They need mentors. They need someone that's been through it, that's seen it, that's done it, right? And you could be that the family mentor in your kind of your take, your view, if you sell it at the right time.
I would argue that about 80% of all family business owners have never explored that, and 80% actually would do that. That role of coach, mentor, honorary chairman, angel investor to other family members, like that's a phenomenal painting that you're developing. I love that. But there is about 20% of business owners who I describe in my newest book who are either grandiose or covert narcissists that are crave control. Business ownership attracts a certain personality. And the very starting point of a really unhealthy personality disorder is this obsession with control. And many business owners suffer from this. And they would never do what you just described. They would never relinquish control. They use their business to control family relationships, to control children, to control everything. And so you can see why a lot of business owners die at their desk. That is the plan. While their children are running the business, so they're pulling salary while their children are running the business. They never relinquish control, never have conversations about how control will shift. That is the guy that gets me out of bed and on planes flying to Vegas to give convention speeches because that guy is toxic. That guy will destroy family wealth. And that actually is the plan. Their plan is no plan. That's the plan. The plan is I'll die. I know the business will fail. And they think that people will then gather around and go, "My God, Bill was an amazing business owner. He died, and so did the business. He was the only guy that could run it. That's how good Bill was." That is the insidiousness of that kind of toxic personality. That's about 20% of CEOs, of business founders.
So that 20%, what should family members do? Let's go to the steps now. Let's go to the steps. How do we, what should family members, because your latest book is about the inheritor, right? And owners, aside from the yearly family meeting. Is that the most critical part of this? And hiring the correct advisors, like finding a really good advisor to facilitate these conversations.
Yes.
What are the steps that if think of our listeners, right? You got the lawyers, the accountants who we've already kind of said maybe not them. Who should be in the room, and how should a business owner start?
I have found over the years that the wealth advisor is best aligned with my perspective, which is drive a liquidity event. It's really easy to transition cash at the estate level. It's really hard to transition a family business at the estate level after someone's died. It's really complex. But cash, super fast, super easy to transition. And you can allocate risk. If I was a financial advisor, Derek, now let's imagine I'm your financial advisor. I come into your office. I've been doing this for a decade. But this year I come into your office, Derek, and I say, "I have a new plan. I want to sell all your US equities, your gold, your T-bills. I want to sell everything because I've got a hunch that one stock that I've got in mind is going to rock and roll. What do you think, Derek?"
I'm finding a new advisor.
I'm finding a new advisor. You're an idiot. Like,
Yeah.
what the hell? Now, explain to me how a business owner with 80% of his personal net worth wrapped up in one illiquid stock called his family business is a perfectly fantastic idea. You
Yeah.
can see that wealth advisors who have business owners as clients, but who have the majority of their wealth stuck with no plan, they are learning how to help business owners with their succession plan, to basically have a liquidity event, to really simplify their estate plans and simplify their retirement. There's nothing more heartbreaking than watching a business owner in their 70s or 80s blow up their business or mistime their liquidity event and destroy their wealth exactly when they need it. There's no time to recover. It's done.
Yeah. And recovery is years. I think business owners don't think if you have one bad year to get back, buyers want to see trends. They want to see, they're not going to give you a pop. They're going to look at that down and they're going to discount. So keeping it running. Okay. Let's go to steps then. So your wealth advisor is probably one key person that can really help you. They're probably motivated to get you to sell. So the money's with them, right? And they got advisor. That's probably a good person. Anybody else that's in those critical conversations?
Yeah, so the accountants and lawyers are part of the family meetings. Absolutely. I'm a speaking resource inside hundreds of family meetings. So it's very common to see the attorneys and the law and the accountants there and the wealth advisors there. Sometimes they're there all the time. Sometimes they're coming in and giving presentations on a tax matter that is impacting the family. But the family meeting has got an agenda. It's got structure and rules and a constitution for the family. And it's just smart. We give so much attention to building wealth, and then we just turn off all of our critical thinking when it comes to transitioning our wealth. The reality is, it's actually harder to transition wealth than make wealth in the first place. It really requires time and energy to prepare the generation to receive that wealth and treat it with the respect that it deserves. Inherited wealth will release potential in the next generation, or it will accelerate demise. It won't equivocate. It will do one or the other. It's a choice. And because families are complex, because there are addictions, and because there are marital breakdowns, because there's just the realities of the modern family, families now especially need good governance. They need good structures. If there's something going on in the family, like an addiction, then advisors can build trusts. And here's a shortcut. For any listener who's wondering if a trust is appropriate, we usually call things the opposite of what they are. If there's something going on in your family with that family dynamics, a relationship that's under stress, and there's a lack of trust, there's probably a good case to be made for the use of a.
Trust.
Exactly.
Cool. Yeah.
They
So,
should be called untrustworthy. I mean, there's something going on where we don't trust that outcome. So we have trustees to make decisions when we're not here.
Yeah. The tr what to do as an owner once you sell, right? One of the questions we ask, well, who's in your team? Who's helping with the sale? I'm doing it myself. This isn't going to sell. Right, they're not ready. They haven't done the hard work. They haven't done the thought process. They're not even thinking about wealth. They're still in deal making business mode. They're doing it just to be almost a deal junkie, right? And have control.
Well, control. There's that personality. And that's that personality, that covert narcissist or grandiose narcissist. They control everything. And they figure that, oh, when the time comes, I'll just lean into this. I'll become masterful at selling my own business. Even though I am the business, no one will be able to figure that out. Are you kidding me? It will take an interested buyer about 5 minutes to figure out how essential that founder is to the business. And you know how I would do it? In fact, I learned this. I was having dinner with someone in your industry, an investment banking guy, and he was telling me, he was bragging about how he prices deals. He said, I would take a target out for dinner. And I'd ask the target, what are you into? I says, I don't want to talk about business tonight. I just really want to get to know you as a person. And he would say to the target, how many rounds, like, what are you into, fishing or golf? And the guy would go, golf. And he goes, how many rounds do you play? And if the target said, well, I only play 3 or 4 times a year, I play a couple of industry conventions and a couple of charity games, but I really love golf. The guy goes, I already know I'm buying that business for a discount. If the target says I play 85 rounds of golf, I love the game, that guy knows that that business owner has people, processes, the business is not dependent on him. Business owners have no idea how they can destroy value by not understanding what buyers really value. And what they really value is free cash flow. I know people are very proud of the colors they've chosen for their new logo that they just paid a graphic designer for, and they may be a profit-sharing company or created some really unique culture. Guess what? That and $2 will get you a cup of coffee. Buyers want cash flow. They want predictability.
Predictability and cash flow. And there's a term for that. It's called key person risk. If there's one person at the top running everything, all of a sudden you got the business, the transferability of that business has gone significantly down. the transfer of the customer relationships, the supplier relationships, all the things, all the knowledge. So we have to discount as a buyer, right? We can't pay premium price. And you're right, it's cash flow. And owners will say, oh, look at all these machines. Well, those machines generate cash flow. What's the cash flow, right? Look at the inventory. The inventory generates cash flow. What's the cash flow? All these people, the people generate cash flow. What's the cash flow? This beautiful building. The building's used to generate cash flow. What's the cash? You can always go back to, you've done this to generate cash flow. What is the cash flow, right? The only thing that
We
matters at the end.
I like to tell a very short story. 6 months before we sold, we had only two competitors. We were a very specialized, unique niche in the plastic industry globally. So we were number two in market share, and we were playing one and three off all the way through the process. We ended up selling to number three, who then became the new number one. We were working on a 10 multiple EBITDA on with both buyers, one and one both potential buyers. I still have a business to run. I'm in St. Louis. I'm with my sales VP. We're going to make a call, our largest customer. And we stop at a Starbucks. I order a small coffee. It's $2. He orders, I don't know, this beautiful, beautiful, it's a massive coffee, it's mochaccino, beautiful, caramel drip. It's $8. I got to spend the next 30 minutes watching him sip $80 out of my sale price. That's an $80 cup of coffee in 6 months. What am I going to do? Normalize my balance sheet for coffee? That's $80 coming out of my sale price. People have no idea how to sell a business, what the rules are. The language is unique. The concepts are unique. And those who try to go it alone, good luck. You're going to leave so much money on the table. The buyer will mop the floor with you. So beginning with the end in mind, building a business that is valuable, building a business that isn't dependent on the owner, building a business that has someone staying and helping the business transition into the hands of the new owner. These are all ideas that take planning, ideas, energy to implement. So I was that guy. My father had voting control. I was getting close, but I agreed to stay and help transition that business into the hands of the new owners. He got to get his check and he got to go home. But that was discussed and negotiated. I was paid to stay. So this idea that the sale of a family business means Junior loses his job and mom and dad make the money, no wonder family businesses don't get sold. They're designed that way. But when you can align the economic interests of both generations, I made money from that deal. I was 45, I had a liquidity event. I had money to go off and do some really interesting things, including this. So it wasn't the end of the line. Very the opposite, in fact. But it really requires business owners to begin with the end in mind. And the sale, and this is the big, big comment. The sale of the family business is not a public acknowledgement of failure. The sale of the family business, what I'm trying to do, is reposition that as the high watermark of success for any intergenerational family.
The sale of the family business is the high watermark for any family business. And for,
That's it.
okay, I got one more question for you. One last question I want to get to, Tom. Say you're junior and you're sitting in the seat because you were there, right? You just said you're there. What is your advice to them? What is your advice to them if dad's the narcissist or if mom's, who's running the business? What is your advice to them?
It's grow up real quick. If you really want to own that business, don't wait for someone else to start that conversation. Walk into your father or your mother's office and say, I'd like to chat about how voting control is going to shift in this business. There's an old saying on the prairies, you can eat a cow one burger at a time. A lot of people think that you got to buy your parents' business all in one shot. But the earlier the rising generation can go and have this conversation and put in place a stock purchase schedule, you can buy one share a year for 10 years, and you got 10. Now you're getting dividends. You can use the dividend stream to buy more shares. And it starts small, but it actually can grow, exponentially quickly if you start early. But most rising gens are intimidated around this subject. They figure they don't want to look like they want to open up a can of worms. So they leave. They'll talk about a lot, but they'll leave the equity alone. They've never touched that subject. They feel like somehow it'll just kind of, I don't know, someone else will start the conversation. That is what I'm saying. It is not about management succession planning. starting the kids off in the warehouse and giving them increasing responsibility. That's easy. How are those shares going to transition? When are they going to transition? At what price? How much? When does voting control change? And if no one wants to talk about that, and if that conversation gets shut down, my advice to that next generation is get the hell out of Dodge. Get out of there. You're going to work like a dog for the rest of your life, and you won't own anything. And you're going to be put into business with your brothers and sisters.
That's good advice. So grow up means a lot of things, right? Go have that difficult conversation right away and start to talk about how you acquire. And if you don't want to acquire, if you don't want to put the risk capital up, go do something else. I 100% agree. Very good. All right. Well, we're running out of time. I could talk with you for another 10 hours. This was fascinating. We normally end it with, I hope you got a couple minutes, just some rapid fire questions. So maybe you can think of junior owner yourself, but just some words for leaders and owners. So I'm going to just go quickly on five of them and then we'll end. How's that? You got about four more minutes for me?
Absolutely. Fire away.
Okay. Courage or compassion?
Compassion.
Compassion. Great ideas or great execution?
Great ideas.
Are you a night owl or early bird?
Oh, early bird.
Early bird, 4 a.m. guy, 5 a.m.
Yeah,
person.
I wrote all my books from 3 a.m. to 5 a.m.
3 a.m. See, you got to get up earlier. I'm big. In a challenging situation, business situation, who do you bring in with you?
My wife.
Oh, good. If there's a word to describe your leadership style, what would it be?
Creative destruction.
Creative destruction. Oh, the old author from Harvard, right?
Jim Peter.
Yeah. Okay. If there's an animal that represents who you are, any animal in the world that represents who you are as a leader, what's the animal and why?
I think I'm a dog.
A dog? Why a dog?
I think dogs are just, hey, any animal that can get people to serve them.
That's
I want to come back. I have the ultimate existential question. I want to come back not as a dog. I want to come back specifically as my dog.
I want to come back as my dogs, right? Any animal that can, you know, what's the ultimate sign of a leader? You can influence people to do what you need to do.
They're masterful.
Masterful. They just puppy they eyes worry, and it goes.
They never worry about tax. Life's good.
Oh, that's the funniest answer I've heard on the podcast yet. Very well. Okay, so I'm going to give you last 5 minutes. Shout out. Where do people go to find your stuff, your books? They're written in a fable style, so they're really easy reads. Like, I still remember the two people on the flight to their Barbados from the first one. Where do they find your stuff, Tom? Don't call him. He's not a consultant. So I got that message loud and clear. But where do they find your readings? Where's a good place to buy stuff, et cetera, and the books? Give yourself some direction to our listeners.
Yeah. I mean, Doug, I mean, I steer people away from Amazon. There's just, I've got over 2 million copies of my books in circulation. A lot of people are selling my books as new, but they're used, they're dog-eared, underlined. That's not me. I don't sell on Amazon. So the best place to get the book, the least expensive free shipping is my website, which is thomaswilliamdeans.com. So thomaswilliamdeans.com, all my books are there, discounts for volume. I sell, the vast majority of my books are sold actually to financial institutions, actually even accountants and lawyers. Even though I'm hard on them, there are a lot of great accounting and law firms that actually really do want to do well by their clients, who really do want to help them with an exit strategy. So, so thomaswilliamdeans.com, you can get the books there. Business owners who are listening to this and think that this would be a really entertaining keynote speech for their next convention, same thing. Go to my website. You can contact me. I have that is what I do. I do 100 events a year all around the world. Like I said, restaurant associations, manufacturing, plumbing, service, tech, all the verticals. The message is the same. If you've got a balance sheet and an income statement, you are a business owner, and that business is going somewhere. Where? How? When? It needs a plan. That's what I talk about. So that's who I am. That's what I do. I love what I do. I've been doing it for over 17 years, and I don't know. I think I'm going to be doing this for a while. Yeah, that last book, The Happy Inheritor, that is a huge, huge subject. A lot of $3 billion inherited every single day, Derek, in America. $3 billion a day. Saturdays and Sundays, $3 billion, $3 billion. It is rolling across the generations, and it's not going well.
Yeah, what an opportunity. I like that you use the term, and it's either gonna inherit, it's either gonna drive down fast or drive up fast. It can do either, right? A plan will help with that. So again, if you're an owner, a lawyer, I was gonna hand these books out. I was gonna start visiting on my visits with owners, just hand it out and say, just have you had this plan? Have you had this conversation? It's not gonna hurt me at all. Like as a buyer, I want you to be honest and open. It's gonna make it easier. I don't want to be the person to deal with your family dynamics while I'm trying to buy your business. That's not fun either. So, yeah, thank you so much. If you're an owner, an accountant, read Tom's stuff. He's the foremost thought leader in this, in transitioning businesses. Very honest opinion. Don't gift it. Make junior buy it. If you're junior, start buying it right now. If you don't want that, get out of Dodge. I think maybe the hell out of Dodge is what you said, but get out. Go do something else. Go do what you're passionate about. Live your own life. Very good conversation, Tom. Thank you so much.
Derek, thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it.